welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Very few items of clothing have excited as much controversy or become such icons of femininity as the corset. Neither do many other articles of wearing apparel have such a long and fascinating history. And we'll explore that history this week with Valerie Steele, author of The Corset, A Cultural History. Following that, our commentary of the week, Talking History regular Henry Butterfield Ryan tells us what he thinks American involvement in Vietnam tells us about our engagement in Iraq. But first, in part one of a two-part series, Dan Roberts offers us another of his moments in time, this one dating to 1864 and to City Point, Virginia.
On a hot, sultry August afternoon in 1864, a huge explosion racked the Union supply wharves at City Point, Virginia. At first, the Federals thought it was an accident.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
City Point was a quiet and peaceful village roughly 10 miles northeast of Petersburg. Today, it is a part of Hopewell, Virginia, but for a brief period in 1864 and 1865, it was the center of the American universe. Determined to break the supply lines between the rest of the Confederacy and its capital at Richmond, General Ulysses S. Grant had besieged Petersburg, which lay at the head of that vital web of railroads spreading south and west. City Point became Grant's headquarters, and its wharves, old and improvised, soon filled with Union food, medicine, supplies, and dangerously, as it would develop, munitions, guns, armament, and gunpowder in huge quantities. Grant and his staff had their headquarters in a U-row of tents in City Point's high bluff, overlooking the junction of the Appomattox and James Rivers, as well as the whirlwind of activity below. On August 9th, the ordnance barge J.E. Kendrick anchored on the quay below, exploded with a horrendous detonation. Bullets, shells, saddles, and the pilot house of the Kendrick and numerous severed bodies all began raining down on the camp. A huge chain whistled right over the tent in front of which Grant was sitting. His shock staff ran to the bluff to check out the carnage below, but the general just sat there and calmly dictated a Washington dispatch describing the event. The initial investigation indicated the Kendrick succumbed to an accident. Not this time. Next time, a rebel secret weapon. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, controversy surrounds a recent program aired by the BBC which sought to expose some of the myths concerning the evacuation of Dunkirk during World War II. Dunkirk, a three-part series, critiqued the popular perception of the selfless courage of the owners of the so-called little boats that went across the English Channel to rescue British troops trapped on the beach at Dunkirk. There were far fewer privately owned little boats than commonly believed, the documentary suggests, and the owners were paid for their efforts. Also exposed are British duplicitousness towards the French in their operation and the poor organization of the British forces. As director Alex Holmes puts it, "Not all people in war behave with simple heroics. The truth is often more complex than that." Dunkirk was an example of what we call spin. The government took a near catastrophe and turned it into the rock on which the war effort was built. This is Talking History. Who can forget the wonderful scene in Gone with the Wind with Scarlett O'Hara holding onto the bedpost for dear life while Mammy struggles to squeeze Scarlett's corset even tighter? The corset is the stuff of myth and legend, as Talking History Eileen Dugan discovered in her telephone conversation with historian Valerie Steele.
It is hard to think of an article of clothing, male or female, that has excited as much passion and controversy in modern times as the corset. Form-fitting and restricting, It is to some an icon of femininity and sensuality, while to others, it's a tool of male dominance. How can an undergarment create such a furor for so long? Well, with us today to discuss the corset is Valerie Steele, curator and director of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology at the State University of New York. Ms. Steele is the author of The Corset, A Cultural History. Welcome, Ms. Steele.
Hello.
Why did you devote an entire book to the history of the corset?
The corset is, I think, the most controversial item of clothing in the entire history of fashion. And so it focuses a lot of the hostility that's directed against fashion in general and brings to light certain issues about gender, sexuality, and the body, which are implicit in other items of clothing, but which really come into focus when you look at the corset.
What has become the standard historical opinion regarding the meaning of the corset or its impact upon women?
The standard historical interpretation actually varies rather little from popular opinion, which holds that the corset is an instrument of male oppression, that women were forced to wear corsets, that corsets were extremely unhealthy, and that women were finally liberated from the corset and lived happily ever after.
Do you agree with this opinion?
I think it's a highly oversimplified picture, which demonizes a particular garment and which makes women of the past appear to be mindless fashion victims when, in fact, they were very much agents for their own actions.
What were the origin myths, if you will, about the corset?
The corset, in reality, developed in the late Middle Ages. But among the myths are that corsets go back in time to ancient Crete. Of course, there are bust bodices and waist cinchers throughout world history, but the actual boned corset is something that developed in the Renaissance. The idea that at the court of Catherine de' Medici, women habitually wore iron corsets that laced them down to 13 inches is a popular myth, but one which is false. Iron corsets existed, but they were orthopedic instruments to try and control curvature of the spine. They were not fashion corsets, which were made of cloth and then some form of boning, most commonly whalebone.
Who were the original wearers of corsets, and when did they live?
Corsets first began to be worn around 1500, a little before that, and the original people to wear them were aristocratic and royal women in Spain, in Italy, and then rapidly also in France, Britain, and throughout the Western world. Fairly quickly, they moved down throughout the upper classes, through the middle classes, and by the 18th century, a significant number of working-class women were also wearing corsets.
What was the purpose of the corset? Was it always to make the waist as small as possible?
Of course, waist cinching was part of the effect, but the corset also functioned as a bust bodice to support the bosom and as an initial layer of underclothing to hold the outerwear together. So you had a skirt and a top, a bodice, which formed two triangles with the points meeting at the waist.
And were they also used for posture reasons?
Oh, doctors believed that the body was basically weak and that you needed to have additional support if you were to grow up straight and tall. So children were put into swaddling clothes in infancy and then into little corsets in childhood. The boys stopped wearing them at about the age that they were breached, about 6 or 7, but girls, because women were thought to be weaker, continued to wear corsets throughout their lives. So corsets lasted really for about 400 years.
During the Enlightenment era and the period of the French Revolution in the 18th century, the corset seemed to change somewhat, and attitudes did. How so?
Well, initially in the 18th century, as before, you had a kind of cone-shaped corset with a bust down the front and then whalebone stays. But many doctors believed that it caused dozens of diseases, and they felt that women who would be liberated from the corset would become better and healthier mothers, and that children would, in fact, grow up straighter without corsets than with them. So there was a brief period in the 1790s when high-waisted dresses came into fashion that many women cut off the bottom parts of their corset and made shorter corsets or even garments which looked very much like a modern brassiere. As soon as the fashionable waistline dropped back down, however, a new kind of corset evolved. This time it was more hourglass in shape rather than cone-shaped, and it was primarily now under clothing, whereas before it had often functioned as part of the outer bodice of the dress.
Was there any relationship in or relationship between the somewhat rejection of the corset in the French Revolutionary period and its association with aristocrats?
Of course, as an element of clothing that had come from aristocratic high fashion, for revolutionaries, it seemed like high heel shoes to be a bad thing, a part of the aristocratic old regime. But the French revolutionaries were by no means feminist. They were not intending to liberate women to take their side with men in now running the new world, but rather women should be healthier breeders if they got rid of their corsets. When the corset came back in, then, it still retained some of the prestige of aristocracy, but with mass production, it rapidly spread even further through the working classes, so that, contrary to what Thorsten Veblen said, the corset was not a sign that the woman who wore it didn't need to work, because working-class women did wear corsets.
Why?
They wore them in part because they wanted to be fashionable, just like their social superiors. They wore them because the corset was a symbol of respectability. It was thought that the straight-laced woman was not loose, in other words, not sexually sluttish, but was respectable, and that was something that working-class women also wanted. And finally, the corset was very much perceived by women of all classes as a beautifying garment which would conceal figure flaws by rearranging the fat and creating what at least looked like a good figure. So as one French writer put it in the 19th century, a woman in a corset is a lie, but we prefer the lie to the truth.
You mentioned earlier the idea of being literally straight-laced, and that reminds me of the Victorian era. How did the Victorians feel about the corset?
Well, I think we tend to think that the corset is a 19th century Victorian garment, but in fact its history goes back through the licentious 18th century, the Baroque 17th century, etc. It's not just to be perceived as part of Victorian sexual politics. What you see in the Victorian era is really the spread of fashion throughout all of the classes, including the spread of the corset. Furthermore, the idea that the Victorians were pathologically anti-sexual is quite false. The Victorians were well aware that women had bodies, including legs, and the corset was seen as something which was beautifying, was eroticizing, but was simultaneously respectable. So that made it one way to sort of funnel sexuality into dress without it being scandalous.
You discuss as well in your book how, especially in the 19th century and in Victorian England, there tended to be a trend of fetishism in tight lacing. Can you describe that?
Oh, yes. There are some fascinating written accounts of extremely tightly laced corsets, which appeared in Victorian periodicals like The Queen and the English Woman's Domestic Magazine in the 1860s and 70s, and then later again in the 1880s and 90s in other magazines like The Family Doctor and Society. These have been taken by most historians to be accurate descriptions of common corset-related behavior. But if you read many of these articles and letters, it becomes more and more clear that they are detailed sexual fantasies which overlap considerably with fantasies about bondage and discipline, sadomasochism, and transvestism. So they really form a kind of fetishist correspondence about the corset. Absolutely fascinating descriptions of tight lacing boarding schools where the sexy but cruel governess Mademoiselle de Beauvoir will lace girls into 15-inch corsets and lace boys who were cross-dressed as girls into tight corsets and so on. These are very interesting, but again, they should be taken as sexual fantasies, not as descriptions of ordinary corset-wearing behavior by the average Victorian woman. It appears that there was a minority of predominantly men who were turned on by the idea of tight corsets and who acted out some of these fantasies, for example, going to brothels where they might have themselves cross-dressed and laced and whipped by prostitutes pretending to be the governess. And this kind of underground imagery of this, the highly erotic corset, continues to the present. But just as the high heels, the extreme high heels worn by a dominatrix today, have little in common with the ordinary woman who wears high-heeled shoes to a party, so also should we not confuse these fetishist fantasies and acting out of the fantasies with the lives of ordinary 19th century women who wore corsets the way women in the 1950s wore girdles.
One of the most familiar images we have associated with corsets is, of course, Gone with the Wind and Scarlett O'Hara being strapped and pulled into her, her corsets. Have to have that waist. And, of course, that leads one to think, oh, that must have hurt. And you know, did that do any medical harm, physical harm to women?
Well, the question of the medical danger of the corset is, of course, related to the question of how tightly corsets were actually laced. And just as these myths of the women tight-laced down to 15 inches have become so common that most people who come to a fashion exhibition will look at a corset on display and they'll say, remember Scarlett O'Hara? Look, that must be 16 inches. She must have had her ribs removed. And in fact, if you measure corsets, you'll find they're normally in the 20s or the 30s in the inches. They're not they're very, very seldom in the teens. And the health effects were similarly not as dramatic and as multifaceted as 18th and 19th century doctors thought. For example, doctors in the 19th century thought that corsets caused virtually 100 different diseases, ranging from scoliosis, the lateral curvature of the spine, to breast cancer, to heart disease, to dividing the liver in half, to having a red nose, to having a host of other, like deformed babies, etc. I've worked with both a nurse and a medical doctor on examining medical accounts of corsetry to explore whether the diseases could have been caused by the corset, whether there's any evidence they were caused by the corset, and whether that evidence is convincing. And we find, for example, that with scoliosis, the curvature of the spine, this was believed for centuries that the corset caused scoliosis. And it's not really surprising because, in fact, the majority of people who have scoliosis are women. So if it was a reasonable guess that their corsets might have caused it, it just happens that the corset didn't. The majority of people who have scoliosis today are still women. It's one of the rare gender-linked diseases that attacks women more than men. In the same way, the idea that tuberculosis was caused by corsetry was disproved by the discovery of the tubercle bacillus. This is not to say that corsetry had no adverse effects. It certainly impedes breathing. It cuts down on your breathing capacity, although that would seldom be a life-threatening thing because you do have restricted breathing if you're obese or if you're pregnant, and those are not fatal conditions. But historians have been way too willing to believe all medical accounts from the past of corset-induced disease. We never would believe that a doctor from the past, doctors from the 19th century, thought, for example, that higher education was bad for women because it sucked all the blood from your uterus to your brain and left you sterile. Now, we'd laugh at that, just as we'd laugh at their ideas that masturbation caused blindness and insanity. But the same historians who would laugh at that have been very credulous about accounts by doctors of corset-related diseases. One so-called doctor, actually a quack, Orson Fowler, described in a variety of books how tight corsets, and by that he meant any corsets, caused by squeezing the lower part of the body, caused the blood to boil down there, and the boiling blood would course through your body up to the organ of amativeness in the base of the brain, thus making you insane and lascivious. Now, I mean, it's truly ludicrous, but even Orson Fowler has been cited by late 20th century historians as being, you know, a doctor who reports how dangerous corsets were. I think that without pretending that the corset had no adverse effects, we need to be much more realistic about assessing what effects can actually be demonstrated. And these are much fewer than the doctors thought.
We only have a moment remaining, but can we just say a few things about corsets today? What is the world of the corset today?
Well, in a sense, the corset didn't so much disappear as it became internalized in the form of diet, exercise, and plastic surgery, such as liposuction. And in part as a result, the corset then reappeared coming out of punk and goth styles to become an element in high fashion, so that many designers create a variety of corsets ranging from, you know, Victorian-style, romantic, historical-looking corsets, which are popular for weddings, to dominatrix and fetish styles, which are popular for certain kinds of club kid ensembles. Across the board, from haute couture to club kids, you can find a variety of corsets, including now even something like Victoria's Secret.
And we mustn't forget Madonna either.
Madonna was very important in helping to create a popular perception of the modern corset as being not oppressive, but rather a symbol of the sexually liberated, sexually aggressive woman. She took sort of a page out of the fetishist fantasy of the dominatrix and turned that into fashion history.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Steele.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Valerie Steele, author of The Corset, A Cultural History.
Once again, American forces find themselves unwelcome in a country they were sent to help. Making reference to our past efforts in Vietnam, our guest commentator of the week, Henry Butterfield Ryan, warns that strategies that did not work in Vietnam won't work in Iraq either. Ryan is an associate of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy and of Clare College, Cambridge.
Memories of the Vietnam War hover over the U.S. occupation of Iraq like sullen ghosts. While the two crises are very different, President Bush needs to recall some striking similarities. Otherwise, Iraq could scar him just as Vietnam did Presidents Johnson and Nixon, even turning Johnson out of office. To escape Iraq undamaged, the president must bring U.S. troops home. Yet, just as they began returning, a guerrilla war erupted that rages today. So as in Southeast Asia in the 1960s and 70s, the casualty lists grow daily. Meanwhile, American policymakers fear that the public has little stomach for steady casualties in a military occupation whose motives are unclear, as were those for the Vietnam War. Furthermore, U.S. soldiers are not hailed as liberators, as the administration predicted, any more than in Southeast Asia all those years ago. Instead, they face a nagging insurgency reminiscent of the one that pulled us ever deeper into Vietnam's Civil War. Citizen troops, reserve, and National Guard form a significant share of America's forces in Iraq. Their numbers could grow if the U.S. increases its troops to contain the guerrillas. Already, citizen warriors and their families have voiced discontent with prolonged active service. Similar resentment among citizens liable for military service in Vietnam helped drive President Johnson from office. Now, in a presidential election year, President Bush risks voter opposition because of unforeseen military problems in Iraq. Consequently, he has taken three measures. First, Iraqis are being recruited for reconstituted police and military units to ease the U.S. security burden, an effort begun even before Saddam Hussein's fall. The same kind of program in Vietnam failed completely. The second measure calls for an Iraqi government to be up and running this summer, a few months before the U.S. elections. Even if this can be achieved, that government could easily lack real authority. It will be hastily created under American guidance in a country of great ethnic, tribal, and religious divisions. If U.S. forces leave before Iraq is stable, its new government will surely crumble. Again, Vietnam provides a troubling precedent. There, Washington shored up a series of weak governments, the last of which was overrun within 2 years of America's departure. The third measure, coaxing the UN to help rebuild Iraq, could prove the most effective. President Bush has always shied away from international administration because it might require surrendering U.S. control. Still, the UN, more neutral than the United States, could help the new Iraqi government cope with the post-war mess while the United States still took credit for toppling Hussein. Invading Iraq was a dangerous and reckless undertaking. And while most Americans still support the president's Iraqi policy, he should remember that most supported Johnson in Vietnam in the beginning.
And finally, we continue our reading of parts of the unpublished Civil War diary of Edwin R. Wilmarth, Union soldier in the 40th Massachusetts Infantry, imprisoned at Andersonville Prison in Georgia. In this week's passage, Wilmarth comments on thieves within their own ranks and the efforts of Confederate Captain Wirtz to discourage such activity. June 29, 1864. Commenced to ferret out the robbers this afternoon. Was told by Rebel Wirtz that we should be protected and help to punish the lawless gang. This was all the boys wanted. Before, they did not dare to raise much of a fuss in camp, as we would be fired on by the sentry. Wirtz sent in a squad of rebels to help us, the only good thing he ever did for us, to my knowledge. The rebels came in and commenced to search them out. They marched them through the camp, and the way the sneaking fellows are marched out is a caution to all the rest left inside. As soon as they were found, they are taken outside the stockade and confined to await their trial. Much money and watches are taken from them, and many think the Johnnies were more interested in that part of it than our own welfare, but were satisfied in getting rid of them. The captain was just come to the gate and said, "We've picked out the ringleaders and shall keep them under ball and chain until such time as jurors from the prison may decide as to their guilt by a regular trial. The remainder will be led into the stockade one at a time, and you may do as you see fit by them." This was enough. Every man that had any strength left took up a club and formed on the street leading into the camp from the gate, leaving a space about 3 feet wide for the criminals to pass through. The gate is now opened, and they, one at a time, are coming in. They're now passing through the space left for the purpose, and it is club, club, whack over the head, across the shoulders, and anywhere we can get the chance to get in a good clip. Most of them are made insensible, and then the boys let up. Many were killed, but I cannot find out how many. I saw five, and there must have been many more. One man, a sailor, came in with a knife in his hand, swinging it first one way, then the other. He cleared his way nearly across the camp, but was finally struck by a billy and made to stop. He was killed before they left him alone. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.